Yo, we are back. Aaron, Jason, myself, Rome. We are back recording a second episode in the same week. We haven't done that in more than a month, but that's because it's finals, baby. Got NBA finals and especially the Stanley Cup. We're recording literally just minutes after game two just wrapped up on a lovely Friday night. Game two was epic, double overtime. It just felt like this game just kept on going and going and going. Almost didn't make it. It all happened with the latest goal scored in Cup history. I think that's what you mentioned, Jason, before we came on. 17 seconds left to tie it up, 4-0. We go a full extra period, 20 minutes. Nothing happens. Lots of close calls. And then probably like the – I do remember when the Florida side – signed Marjan, probably one of the biggest signings in the offseason. He comes up big again with the game-winning goal, just slipping in between the legs to take the victory 5-4.
That was a mid-season trade. So that was one of the – we talked about the last episodes, one of the salary cap manipulation deals right there, getting, you know, basically a big-time player from another team. And a lot of questions around that one, as we mentioned in the last episode. But the dividends in this episode or this game particularly.
Series, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, him scoring the shorthanded goal in the second period that puts him up and then ultimately the game winning. But yeah, it's turned out to be a huge goal or a huge addition that I think many Florida Panther fans were iffy on because you were getting one of the best players from your rival that you basically, you know, ended their little bit of a run out in Boston.
Remember, an enemy of my enemy is my friend.
There you go.
Great game, man. So let's start from the beginning. In the first period, there was a lot of power plays in there, and I just felt like Edmonton didn't really capitalize on it. I don't know if you guys want to expound on that a little bit more, Jason. What did you think of that, especially when they had like a 5-3 advantage, and I think had like what 3 or 4 minutes with that before they still had a couple more minutes when they had a 5-4 advantage, and they just I think they mustered one goal in the beginning to either go up 2-1, I believe, or maybe it was 3-2, but then not much after that.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the power play percentage in the game, like you're talking about, Ron. The Edmonton had six power play opportunities, only got one goal, and then even allowed the shorthanded goal to Marchand that we're talking about. So when you get down to it in the playoffs, you know, being efficient and making the most of power plays could be the difference in the game, and especially early. I mean, Florida got put on the board early, you know, with the power play goal from Sam Bennett to really, you know, kick off the game. And that kind of set the tone. And then there was just a flurry of goals really following that. I mean, 7 minutes into the game, I know Roby texted me just how crazy the game was because you had Evander Kane and then Evan Bouchard quickly putting the Oilers up 2-1. And then Seth Jones immediately following that. In tying the game, and then they get on the power play, and that it was Edmonton's only successful power play, and probably one. Man, I know there's a lot of talk about Connor McDavid, but the one power play conversion that Edmonton had for the Draisaitl goal midway through the first period, the stick handling from McDavid to that pass, like literally between like three dudes' legs,
that was so beautiful.
Yeah, to get to Draisaitl, I mean, these are the things, as I tell people who are not hockey fans or watch a lot of hockey, that, you know, they get into the finals and you talk about like the greats in the sport and why Connor McDavid is considered, you know, one of the all-time greats. It's just you just don't understand how good this guy is compared to everybody else on the ice.
Okay, I couldn't remember who you were talking about, but then after watching this game like closely, like, you know, from start to beginning, I'm like, dude, this guy is fucking amazing. It's like watching Kyrie Irving on skates.
Yeah, he just does so many things that just don't look possible that you can do on skates. And especially, I mean, he's a bigger guy for hockey, too. So for how fast he is, he just cuts through the defense and is able to stick handle around and do so many creative things. And really everything he did to set up that goal of the Draisaitl. You asked me, Rome, going into the second overtime, how's this end? I was going to say yeah. McDavid to Draisaitl again. There was a glimmer right there at the front. They were broken at the start of that second overtime. I'm like, this is going to be it right there. And Draisaitl just couldn't put it home. But I mean, that first period really was just so telling. And I mean, that is them scoring on the power play, going up 3-2, that was, you know, the most successful portion of that Edmonton game right there. But I agree with you to, you know, to start the premise of this, you know, 1-for-6 in the power play, not going to get it done. But if you give the props to Florida in this one, you know, the Florida defense, the broadcast was talking about Gustav Forsling and just what he was doing, you know, with the stick, poking, you know, poking everything out of the way, getting, you know, chances that Edmonton was getting close to the net on. I think some of the defense for Edmonton, or I'm sorry, for Florida was really key in that, because whether it was in full strength or on the power play, they were not allowing Edmonton to get that puck close into Bobrovsky. So you got to give credit where credit's due. And those guys were diving in front of stuff too, left and right. I mean, you saw the second overtime, people were just, you know, I forgot who came off the ice for Florida, but just basically just took a shot to the wrist, and other people were diving in front of stuff. It's just the defense there was helping Bobrovsky a lot.
Yeah, Rome. I mean, first period, a lot of penalties on both sides. You know, we got power play goals there by both teams there. I think it was a 5-on-3 for about 20 seconds there, and then it got back to a 5-on-4 pretty quickly. But yeah, I mean, like Jason, you guys recapped, Florida's defense really came through on that power play, 1-for-6. That's not going to get it done. Remember, they got the overtime goal in game one on a power play, McDavid to Draisaitl. That capped that victory. I thought a big, big play for this game that really kept Florida in it was in the second period earlier on the power play. Evan Bouchard gets stopped on an open net. McDavid set him up. He was on the, you know, he came off the ice. He was basically beating his head with a stick because he knew, I mean, he had it. I mean, the goalie was out of position, kind of just lunged forward right off the glove. That would have put him up 4-2, all the momentum. Who knows what would have happened from there. But you get Brad Marchand with a shorthanded goal, and he was just a pest. He's just one of those guys, him and Corey Perry, say what you want. Like, when the puck finds their stick, good things happen. I mean, Corey Perry, you know, scoring with 17 seconds left. I still looking at the replay, don't know. He's basically falling down and just, I don't even know how the stick gets on the puck, and the puck's just basically doing a 180 going through the net there. Crazy wild times there. I mean, empty net, but, you know, Florida at the time was doing a lot of, you know, icing it. They were icing it, so their defenders were tired. Edmonton just kept the pressure on them. And the game, as it kept going, outside of that second period where Florida was just really, really keeping the pressure on Edmonton, could have gotten a couple more goals. Skinner kept them in the game. But Edmonton, pace-wise, McDavid, Draisaitl, I like what they were doing, Kane and stuff. But, I mean, Florida's the champs. These teams won 7 games last year. We've gotten overtime in both of these matchups. It looks like we could be going for another 7-game set here, guys.
Yeah, one thing I really McDavid, man, he's so quick. Like, it just seemed like he had, like, all these fast-break point opportunities. I'm just going to call him fast-break for the sake of the argument here. And then I thought the Florida Panthers, man, like when they were diving and trying to stop them, like literally just like shoestring tackles throughout the whole game, especially in the second. And no, I think mainly the third period, there was a few of those where Edmonton had a couple opportunities to take advantage on a 3-2 advantage. And it was pretty amazing. Like, what's like the biggest takeaway you guys have from this game? You know, like, now we go back-to-back overtime games in the Stanley Cup. I think this is the first time it's happened since 2000 or 2020, at least. The bubble, I think they were mentioning on the broadcast. But pretty epic series. How is Edmonton, like, bummed because now they're going back to Florida tied up? Is Florida happy because they at least took one away? What's the thoughts here?
I think Florida did what they had to do. They had to take one in Edmonton. They obviously pushed both of these games to the limit. I mean, Edmonton's probably bummed they're not just taking a commanding lead 2-0 going into it, but I think at the same time, they're going to have the opportunity down in Florida, and it is the home ice really going to matter that much? Probably not in this series. Like, you want it and you say it matters, but I just think these teams are so evenly matched, and you just have some of the best players. And when you look over the last 2-3 years, these are the two best teams in hockey. So it's like you said, it could be a game 7. The broadcast was talking about, I think it was bigger for Florida to win this game. I agree. I can't remember who the broadcast was saying, because if Edmonton went up 2-0 and then it was going back to Florida, man, that's a really, you know, thing, because I imagine Edmonton's going to take one in Florida regardless. So if they're taking one out of Florida and they're up 3-1 coming back to Edmonton, you know, that's a tall task. So I I think is for Florida. This keeps them alive in the series. It's basically even. I guess you could say Florida took the home ice away, but I think it's just you're going to be trading shots, you know, back and forth. But it's going to, like Aaron mentioned, it's going to be guys like Corey Perry and Brad Marchand, these guys that are just, you know, the annoying pest that's going to be around. They're slapping your stick. They're getting everyone's face. They're just the agitator on the ice, but they're going to be make big plays. You know, it's those things that are going to happen where a third and fourth line guy are going to make big goals. You know, even, you know, Evander Kane, and Corey Perry, you know, these are guys that were like superstars for their team, you know, 10 years ago and stuff. And yeah. now they're playing vital roles, being third and fourth line guys that are just, you know, being able to, you know, pick it up where, you know, those are the names you generally see. When I think of Blackhawks, my Blackhawks back in the day, it was guys like Dave Boland and stuff like that, that Rome, you've never heard of, that were scoring some big goals down the stretch where, you know, but you're going to get the big moments from the stars too. And I think Leon Draisaitl, he didn't show up last year. We talked about it. He was a big disappointment in the final. Had a goal tonight. He almost put one in past Bobrovsky. Was probably like an inch and a half too low on the pad of Bobrovsky at a certain point that would have put Minton up and probably the game winner at that point. So I think the stars are going to come out to play, but you're going to be looking for these other guys in the series that potentially make a big play here and there. So I still like Edmonton. I picked them. I think did I pick them in six? I'm forgetting. I picked them in seven.
Yeah, we took them in six. Yeah.
Yeah. Took them in six. So we were boring, agreeing across the board, but still going to be a great series. And about, you know, Florida's going to have to hold court here. They're going to have to really make the most of what's going on here.
Yeah. I mean, Rome, I think Florida's thrilled. They have to be thrilled. I mean, you heard them at the end of the game. If you were listening to the broadcast, a few F bombs for sure being let out there by Florida getting that victory.
I didn't catch it.
They earned it. I mean, I think you're Florida. You're feeling pretty good. If you're 5-on-5, you like how you're playing. Their power play defense was good tonight. It really came down and hurt them in game one. Draisaitl has a couple goals. He's got 3 goals already in 2 games. Like Jason just mentioned, no goals last year. McDavid still being McDavid, but they've kept him from scoring any goals. He's gotten close in both these games. I think if they can keep him from scoring and, you know, Draisaitl gets his, to be okay. But yeah, again, the other guys, the Perry, Brad Marchand, those guys, if they continue to step up, make plays, Kane, like you mentioned, Jason, the others are going to be big for them. Evan Bouchard, he's, you know, averaging over 1+ point a game, one of the top 5 scores for defensemen in NHL playoff history. So he's got to continue to play good. He had a couple chances. He made one, missed a few good looks. I mean, Florida feels great winning this game, but we know no lead is safe between these teams. It was 3-0 last year. Edmonton was able to come back and force a game 7. Edmonton's been really good on the playoffs on the road here. Florida's been kind of shaky back and forth at home. I agree with Jason. I think Edmonton's going to win one game there. It comes back to Edmonton 2-2. And even if it's 3-1, one way or the other, I don't think any team's going to lose confidence because these teams are pretty evenly matched. But, you know, power play-wise, Edmonton's got the advantage. Or if it even goes 4-on-4, that's going to benefit McDavid of the open ice too. So Florida, if you can stay out of the penalty box, there was no penalties in the third period and all the overtimes.
Overtime, yeah.
So that was big for them.
Yeah, they're doing a couple things in the game for Florida. They win the game, but you got guys that have been a little silent for them as some of their stars in Florida. So, you know, Alexander Barkov, you know, great two-way player. It was -3 on the day. So we really haven't got, you know, one of their top guys going. Matthew Tkachuk has been very silent in this series as well too. So you got, you know, Marchand and that Sam Bennett was big in this game too, but you haven't seen some of the big guys that usually you're accustomed to seeing with Florida in last year's run. I think Carter Verhaeghe had some pretty good stuff in this game too, but I mean, he had the one assist, but he was even on the day as well. So I think you got, there's still more left in Florida and some guys that haven't shown themselves in this series yet. Tkachuk, you wonder how healthy he is throughout these playoffs and whether he's really been at full health. I think there's still something more for Florida, but you know, you'll start seeing guys maybe like, you know, we saw Victor Arvidsson a little bit. You got veterans like Adam Henrique and we mentioned Evander Kane, Ryan Nugent Hopkins, you know, for Edmonton has been pretty silent so far too. So there's some guys here that really haven't picked their moment yet that are probably going to be seeing in games 3 and 4.
Yeah, I think Kachuk's banged up. I mean, he looks to me like he's skating at about 70-75%. I mean, he has not been real aggressive. Defensively, he's been good, but he hasn't been very aggressive. Reinhart, he's another guy, I think, for Florida. He had a chance on a, you know, breakaway there that got stopped there, I think, in the first overtime. And Verhaeghe, I think he's going to get a goal in Florida. So if there's a prop bet for him to score a goal, he's been close. He's going to get one in either game three or four. So I would bet that at plus money when you get the chance on that one, because he's going to get a goal.
Interesting. I noticed that Bennett was like in a lot of the plays that made things happen for Florida. It seemed like he had a big part, at least a hand, maybe like not the assist, but at least like he kind of led some of those breaks that led to goals.
Yeah, I mean, Bennett was all over the place. And like I mentioned, Gustav Forsling, Aaron Ekblad defensively for Florida was all over the place. So, I mean, there were some guys that were just leaving it all out there. Matthias Ekholm and Darnell Nurse. I mean, Darnell Nurse is a guy that's really, when you think about the core of this Edmonton team, Nurse has been that supposed to be that staunch defenseman that they got in there, you know, but they're balancing a lot of the shifts out defensively there for Edmonton. But I think the difference in the night, besides we talked about what Marchand did, I was more impressed with like the Florida defensemen as I'm looking inside the game, because I think Edmonton could have ended that game several times over, but Forsling, yeah, and Ekblad and Seth Jones and some of those guys in front of the net, they really helped Bobrovsky there. Even Bobrovsky made some big saves, because overtime turns into which goalies kind of got to make the mistake, and obviously, and it was Skinner, and I was ready to say this is going to be Skinner's bad game early on. He's going to let this go in, but then he was good really for like that third period and then early overtime.
He had some great stops.
He did. It was there. And Bob did too. But I think the Florida defense made it easier for Bobrovsky than potentially the Edmonton defense did for Skinner.
Yeah. I mean, Florida's defense, like Jason mentioned, really, really helped them out a lot, because Edmonton seemed, at least in that third period, they were coming. I mean, I'm like, when are they going to get a goal? When are they going to get a goal? And then like time was running out, and then eventually they got the goal. But the pressure they put on, I mean, outside of that second period, which we talked about, Florida dominated it from start to finish, which they did in game one. I mean, Edmonton's really kind of been skating around doing their thing. So yeah, the defense for Florida was great, but will they wear down? Can they keep it going? I believe they can, but we'll see. We'll see how it plays out.
Nice. You guys want to recap game one real quick?
Are you moving to basketball?
No. Okay. Game one of the Stanley Cup still, because that was epic. Florida was up in the third period. And then Edmonton comes back and wins that in dramatic fashion as well.
Yeah, I think there was probably genuine concern in game one when you're thinking about a year ago, where Florida goes up 3-0. And, you know, with them, Florida up 3-1 early in the second period, Arvidsson made it close in the second period. And then, you know, Ekholm was able to tie it in the third. But I think early on in that game, when Florida's up 3-1, you're thinking this is the worst case scenario for Edmonton starting the final at home.
That, yeah,
they're already behind the eight ball. Yeah. And that's where it was. And like, where is it starting? Cause that is, you know, the one thing, and I guess we're talking game one, but I think even looking at game two, like face-offs in both of these games has favored Florida. It's basically been like a 55-45 split on Florida to Edmonton. And even the broadcast was talking about some of the stuff Draisaitl was doing. He's basically just locking up the other center, you know, not even allowing him to go through. But like, I think Florida winning some of these faceoffs, especially in game one, was potentially like a lift for them, because just from the possession standpoint of what Florida was able to get. But at the end of the day, in that, even though they won more faceoff, I think it was 56-43 in game one, the shots on goal that Edmonton was putting on, particularly later in the game, was all the difference, because you had the shots advantage for Edmonton 46-32. And then so when it came to overtime, you know, Draisaitl was able to put it away with that power play goal. So I think either way, when you look at these games, man, they're just so close. These teams are just so close, and you're just waiting for, like, what's the one mistake that's going to get it? Like, you know, the shorthanded goal in game two was just kind of insane. And just, you know, you let Draisaitl or let McDavid, you know, have some open ice and do some insane movements, you know, Edmonton can take advantage.
I thought the big mistake from Edmonton in this game was when they had the power play in the first period and they allowed Florida to score a goal. That was like a pretty bummer, pretty big bummer. And then at least like I don't watch too much hockey. I think this is the first year I've been to like multiple hockey games in the same season, maybe ever. I'm not really sure. But Edmonton just looks so much more skilled than Florida. But Florida just looks like they take advantage of their opportunities more, or they just look a little more powerful on the offensive front when they do get those open gaps.
If Florida, if you look at their kind of evolution over the past couple years, they won the President's Trophy and went out early in the playoffs, you know, 3-4 years ago. You know, they're the best team in the regular season and went out early in the playoffs and basically revamped their entire team. And it was the Matthew Tkachuk trade that was the thing. It was like, hey, we basically traded away a bunch of our guys and got a different superstar, but traded away into a team that wasn't going to be as much of a, let's just say, like a high flying scoring offense, that was going to be much more like in your face, you know, challenging for the puck. And that's really kind of what they've played these last, you know, 3 years as they've gone to the, you know, the finals 3 years in a row. If you remember 3 years ago when they lost in the finals, they were the 8 seed and went all the way to the finals. And then these last 2 years, you know, have been obviously top seeds in the East. So, but they are not like this high flying offense. They are taking advantage. They're wearing you down. It's a cliche thing, but it's playoff hockey, and they weren't built for the regular division, the regular season. They're built for the playoffs. And that's where, hey, it's a physical style to play. You're hitting, you're taking advantage. And when you're talking about the skill level, yeah, I think the skill level is a thing. Edmonton has the two best players in this series with Draisaitl and McDavid. They have two of the best, four players in the NHL. But you know, the physicality that you're going to get from everyone on the Florida roster, like it's a different type of style. And that's where there's a little bit of a clash. But I think Edmonton with some guys like Perry and Kane and a couple other guys that are on there, like they're going to combat that a little bit. But your observations are right, Rome, even with your 200% increase in hockey attendance this year.
Where was Evander Kane before? What was he with the Kings a long time ago?
No, he would have been up by you in San Jose for a little while. That's probably why you remember.
I don't actually. I don't. I just know of him. I've probably seen highlights.
Yeah, I mean,
I just don't know what team he played for.
Of Evander Holyfield when he hears Evander. Evander
Kane.
Oh, cool, man. There's a few brothers on the ice, man. I kind of
got
dug
Nurse.
It.
You got Kane out there.
He's been a little. He's been around. He's been in the league so long. He was on the Atlanta Thrashers, if you remember the old Atlanta
Thrashers.
The Atlanta
sounds like a wrestling tag team.
No, yeah. Dude, like a MLS startup.
Well, the Thrashers were the expansion NHL team out there who then moved to Winnipeg and became the Winnipeg Jets to take back that name. You remember the Atlanta hockey franchise did not work out, but he's been all around. He was with the Thrashers, moved with the Thrashers when they became the Winnipeg Jets, played for the Sabres, and then he was up by you in the Bay and the Sharks for the past like 4 or 5 years until he went to Edmonton. So,
okay. I got to say, I really like the Oilers jerseys and logo, and not so much the Panthers. Though the Panthers looks like a kind of like some made up like NCAA college football team.
You think this is the create?
Golf Coast Florida Gulf Coast team from the NCAA tournament 15 seed.
I just remember, you know, when we were kids, man, I'd be like knocked out, dude. Aaron's spending hours and hours and hours creating like a new team or something like that. And this is something that he would probably do. Like I'd be waking up like, oh, dude, I just knocked out 3 seasons, won the championship.
Yeah, I'll say it is not, you know, we can be the old men in the room. I'll say it's not the vintage throwback Florida Panther where it's kind of like coming at you at the screen. It's the John Van Beesbrook. Yeah, the John Van Beesbrook Florida Panthers from like 93 or the 1996 Stanley Cup final team. The Florida Panther logo now, you know, it's got kind of a shield look, a little bit of a panther that's you know, got the sideways, a little more I guess a little prestige to it. It's not the panther coming at you with the claws like the old logo used to be.
Prestige worldwide, wide, wide.
There you go.
Sorry, that's why I hear that word.
But I think the Oilers is classic. Hasn't really changed, man. It's been just some classic. They haven't done a ton of alterations to it.
It's a cool fucking logo. That's all I gotta say. Any more feedback on the Stanley Cup?
I mean, it's been a great first two games, both overtime. This is what playoff hockey's about. This is why it's the best postseason out there. I think it'll be a thrilling. Don't shake your head at me, Rome.
It's good. I got to admit, it's pretty exciting.
Listen.
I'm memorizing a lot more players' names, so it's going to give me a lot more to look forward to next season.
Absolutely. But yeah, the games in Florida are going to be a lot, you know, probably, you know, likely a split between the two.
Is it 2-2-1-1-1 format?
Yes. So
good old days. Still in hockey.
I got to tell you, these guys probably, well, I don't know who likes it or not, but the flight from Edmonton to Florida has got to be brutal, because I don't think there's a direct from Miami to Edmonton. I'm pretty sure you got to probably fly to like Denver or something like that to go across.
To be honest with you, I don't know where Edmonton is on a map.
Edmonton is in the province of Alberta, I believe.
Let's look it up.
It is the northernmost professional like sports franchise in like our main sports. Like it is north. It is on a high latitude, longitude.
Yeah, I mean, they did a thing last year for travel. I forget if it's like 2,300 or 2,800 miles from Edmonton to Florida. So direct flight, whatever it is. So yeah, it's a long flight for sure. But yeah, these playoffs, hockey, finals have been great. We're going to touch on the next segment, the NBA. But I mean, what we've seen so far in the finals from both sports, I think it's been the best finals we've seen in a while, for sure. And I'm excited to see how it finishes up. But yeah, I expect probably a split going forward there in the two games in Florida.
It looks like it's the biggest city north that high around the whole world.
Yeah, I mean, they got oil, you know, big oil town.
Really? Oh, well, I was going to ask where the Oilers' name came from. Like, did they come from Texas that ended up over there? But yeah, sure.
No, big oil industry up in Alberta up there.
Sure, there's a lot of dead dinosaurs in there. Makes a lot of sense. No, that's an epic travel flight, dude. What's that got to be? To go down to Florida? That's ridiculous.
Well, that's why they're giving us the extra day, not game three, not till Monday. And then Monday. Game four Thursday, so...
Oh,
a few days of rest for both these teams.
Okay, well, that's good. Well, travel's a lot better these days. All right.
Yeah, that still ain't a fun flight.
No, it's not a fun flight.
Especially if you're Edmonton and you lost. If you're Florida, you're feeling pretty good. The flight feels good always going back home after a win. I don't care where you're at.
If someone wants to look up that flight, I'm just really curious.
I don't know if there's the direct, to be honest with you.
All right, let's do a quick transition. NBA Finals kicked off couple days ago. Sixers with the biggest upset for game one. It kind of reminded me of when the Philadelphia 76ers upset the Lakers when the Lakers were going for that undefeated streak in the playoffs and then got stunned in game one before the Lakers turned around and won four straight to go 16-1, whatever it was, to claim what was,
I think
like
it was 15-1 because that was a best of five first round.
That's true. 15-1. But OKC, they led throughout the whole game. They were up significantly in the first half. Then Indiana just keeps on chipping it away. And once again, Indiana down, how much was it? 13 inside of 4 minutes?
15. Well, no, they're down 15 from 9 minutes ago.
15, 9 minutes ago, still, that's still a lot. And then they were still down by 9 with like, what, a minute and a half to go?
I don't think that, maybe 4 minutes.
And then, you know, they tie it up, and then Tyrese Haliburton voted the most overrated player in the league, pops back.
Most overrated?
He was voted the most overrated player in the league.
By his peers.
Wow. Definitely, he wouldn't have got my vote for that. He's more than one of the underrated players in the league, but...
Game-winning two-pointer from the far side. And OKC's stunned, man. What'd you guys think?
I mean, stunned for sure. I mean, I'm not shocked that Indiana won.
I'm still shocked for your seven game prediction.
I'm one of the few that said this is going to be a deep series. I think this is just going to be just like the hockey final. It's going to be all these games are going to be pretty tight. They're going to be pretty close. Maybe OKC comes out and blows them out game two. But Indiana played terrible that first half. 19 turnovers. They're a team that averages 12 a game. They had 19 in the first half. Finished, I think, with 24. But their defense was great. They held the Thunder to, what, like 40% shooting overall as a team. Only gave up 11 points off those 25 turnovers. And they kept grinding. They keep fighting. I mean, we've seen Indiana do this throughout the playoffs. They did it to Cleveland. They did it to New York. And now they do it again to OKC. And again, Haliburton, the only time they led is at the end of the game. That's all that matters.
That's all that matters, yeah.
That's all that matters, man. And then, you know, we touched on it. They were getting 10 points. That was disrespectful by the bookmakers. I think
was it 10 by game
now
time?
I know it's
9.5.
Now they're getting 11 in this next game. I mean, yeah. I don't know when people are going to wake up, but Indiana's a good team. It's not going to be an easy series for the Thunder to win.
OKC typically responds from losses, though, in a big way, and then they pummel the opponent. I think that's why it's kind of increasing on this one.
Similar. I mean, look, this is kind of a similar fashion to game one against Denver. Remember, Aaron Gordon hits the three of like a second left, and then the next game they got beat by, what, 40?
That series
ended up going seven games, so yeah. We'll see. I think it's going to be a deep series.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I mean, you guys are a little more of the basketball aficionado, but I don't know if there's been a more disrespect is maybe a too strong word, but more of a disrespected team that's made it to the NBA Finals like the Pacers, because literally anyone was going to say it was going to be anyone but them. It was going to be the Celtics. It was going to be the Knicks. It was going to be the Cavaliers. The Bucks were going to get it together. Like, I don't think anyone wanted to give this team the shot and where it's at. And out of anything out of this game, Aaron said it. It was only leading at that last couple seconds and where it was at. The only thing that mattered, what you get up from Haliburton in this game, particularly in game one, but then throughout the playoff, have been these moments that are potentially to be iconic for his career. Because you're going to remember this, like, you know, Jordan game six versus the Jazz, or Jordan versus Cleveland in that early playoff rounds where it goes to, like, you're going to have some of these moments if it's just at the beginning of what Tyrese Haliburton is. And we're going to potentially remember this run if he's able to, win this series if it goes on. And then I was thinking that the other team too, head coach of this team, Rick Carlisle.
Yeah.
Last time he took a team that was kind of an underdog too and won the NBA Finals with the Mavericks. You know, this guy, he's been around the league. I think he's always been seen as one of the better coaches in the league.
He's a really good coach.
But now you're taking, you know, this Pacers team, you know, potentially to an NBA championship, and it would be his second. I mean, that's up there for one of the best coaches probably we've had in this generation for what he's done, because he's had incredible regular season teams throughout that. It's just been where the championship, he's never had the championship run like Kerr with the Warriors or Pop or some of these guys, but, you know, where he's kind of wielded these teams to these pretty, you know, amazing runs. This is something that's kind of a legacy builder for Carlisle too. But, man, to me, it's just the moments with Haliburton right now. Cause I mean, I'll take my news from Twitter, and it just turns,
it's getting kind of crazy on Twitter.
It's crazy on where it is. I mean, there's a lot of things crazy on Twitter yesterday.
Have you seen it, Aaron? So they're calling Haliburton,
Halicurry or whatever.
No, they're kind of comparing him to like the Taliban.
Okay, no, I haven't seen that.
It's pretty great, but like NBA Twitter has no chill.
Yeah, I think it's the Haliban or something like they call
the
it.
The Haliban, like, yeah.
So, but
the Haliban bombs New York again or something like that. It's getting kind of, it's crazy.
It's borderline, but I don't know if that's what you'd remember out of it, but I just think when things like that trend, or even just what you're talking about in these moments, like everything was just about Tyrese and kind of that stuff. And what he, like I said, I'm bringing my own personal into this, but what he does outside the court, and like, you know, he's a massive wrestling fan, and just kind of, you know, he feeds the star power of this stuff too, where he does these outsized things that just, he's going to turn him into a potential face of the league because he embraces some of this, all this stuff, and then has these, you know, incredible moments on the court too.
Well, Tyrese Haliburton, man, he's a different star for sure. Cause he's really nerdy. kind of geeky, you know, and he's unabashed about it either. And he didn't even have a great game, and he still comes out clutch in the fourth quarter, and they pull one out, and that's the scary part. Oklahoma City, they're probably like one of the teams, the rare teams where their best player, SGA, he puts up 38 points or something like that. And most teams that have like a superstar that are scoring at will like that, it's like hit or miss, you know. Typically, like when your star player has the ball too much, you're losing half those games. OKC kind of breaks that mold. Like they're winning almost every single game, regardless of how SGA plays, because they're just so deep and they play so well as a team. So for them to kind of take a big shit like this, and then them kind of like, I don't know, their interview, maybe it's just me, but them kind of like chalking up like, well, you know, it's just not a loss, whatever. But it's the finals, man. Hopefully that wakes them up. I think they're going to blow them out in game two.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you on that, because everyone was talking in the game. There was a couple stats in this game that were pretty interesting to me, because it was the Pacers 25 turnovers versus
Oklahoma City's only seven.
But then at the same time, on the flip side, what puts the Pacers back in that game was them being 46% from three. And then they also had 56 rebounds to Oklahoma City's 39. And so, like, we're turning the ball over, but we're also draining, you know, they were draining threes, and then anything they were missing, they were recovering. So, I mean, there were some wild swings in some of the statistics when you break it down where the Pacers were at. So what's going to regress to the medium? Like, are they going to get less turnovers, but then let's be efficient, you know, from 3 points? Because that's kind of one of those things, some two anomalies both ways for the Pacers.
Yeah.
No, I think you noted. I think the Pacers, you have to feel great. I mean, they've been shooting 41% from the 3-point line. They shot 46 in that game, but like Jason said, 25 turnovers. I said they averaged 12.
That's a lot. Well,
here's the key, though. After 25 turnovers, they only gave up 11 points.
Really?
So they only had the capability. If you take 25 possessions, time that by two, they had the chance to give up 50 to 75 points if you added the 3-pointers. They gave up 11. They only lost the battle 11-4 in turnover points and gave up 18 more possessions that way. And then fast break points, even. So where they won the game, rebounding and 3-point shots. So now they only gave up 5 turnovers in the second half. I think they figured out the pace of play with Oklahoma City. And that worries me if I'm Oklahoma City, because they were on the ropes in the first half and you didn't pin them away. Now you gave a team that's an underdog a lot of confidence that says, hey, not only can we play defense and defend these guys, we'll let SGA do what he's got to do. Williams has got to be a lot better for OKC if they're going to win the series. Every game he's had a bad game, he's bounced back in game two. But I think pace of play, I think Indiana gained a lot of confidence. And I think what Rick Carlisle, smart coach, second half, he had Halliburton playing off the ball. He had Nembhard take the pressure. So guess what, Dort, you're a great defender, but now you're not on the ball. We're going to get you off the ball. We're going to get to our offensive sets better. I like what Indiana's doing. And Siakam didn't have a great game.
He did.
He's going to be better in this series. And they can match these guys depth for depth, player for player. Indiana's a better team than OKC. I took OKC because they have SGA, but Indiana's a better team from top to bottom. I wouldn't be surprised if they win this finals.
I wouldn't say they're a better team from top to bottom.
They're a better team from top to bottom. And guess what? Like Jason said, they got the better coach too. Carlisle's a better coach and he's more proven. We're underestimating how good Carlisle is. And guess what? There's only been one coach, I believe, ever in NBA history to win a game down 15 points in the fourth quarter. That was the Dallas Mavericks over the Miami Heat in the 2011 NBA Finals. Rick Carlisle was your coach there too.
Did you guys see that clip that's going around social media? It was Brown from the Celtics after they played Indiana last year.
Can't say that I have.
Look it up.
Was it after game one or something?
I can't remember.
After they swept them?
It was after Tyrese hit a game-tying shot or a game-winning shot in one of those games. And
they didn't win a game last year in the playoffs.
No.
Who? They should have won game one. I think Brown hit a three in the corner to send it to overtime, and then Halliburton got hurt, game two early, and then they just got swept. So
it was just, Brown was just saying, like, man, like all of a sudden all the players from Indiana were playing like Michael Jordan, like playing their lights out. Like, it's a good fucking team. Like, they're deep. Like, they just have all the confidence in the world to play really good, and like, they're going to be dangerous for years to come.
Remember, Rome, I know we weren't doing the show last year. I'd said Indiana would get to the Eastern Conference Finals last year and potentially beat Boston.
Well, I told you I liked them once I saw them live against the Warriors. Good. I'm like, dude, this team's good.
They're really, really
Same
good.
Same thing with OKC. I was like, dude, this team's solid too.
Yeah, they're both really, really good teams. And that's why, like, you know, when people were saying it's going to be four-game sweep or a gentleman sweep, I laughed that off. It could still possibly happen, but maybe it happens for Indiana in five over OKC. That would be extreme shocking. But the series has 6-7 games written all over it, I believe.
Jason.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still sticking with the Thunder. I'm as much as I want to brood for Halliburton and what the Pacers can do in this, I still think the Thunder are the best team. But to Aaron's point, it wasn't going to be a sweep or a gentleman sweep. I think the Pacers are going to have these games, but I agree with what you guys are saying. Game two, it could be a blowout for the Thunder.
Yeah. Great win by the Pacers to go up 1-0 in the NBA Finals. If the Pacers in some form of fashion, if they end up winning the championship, it'll definitely be because they outcoached the OKC Thunder. For sure, because the Thunder, by all stats, by all measures, is like the one of the most dominant teams in NBA history. It's lining up for them to win the championship unless they completely take a mental shit. And that's possible. It's happened before, but not at this magnitude of how much they've dominated play in the regular season and the postseason.
Yeah, Rome, you talk about the stats. Their margin of victory is crazy, both playoffs and regular season. But you touched on it earlier in pods before the playoffs, clutch games, they call it. They didn't have
any. They don't have any. They didn't have any coming into the playoffs.
And now in the playoffs, now you're in the finals.
Well, they've been tested, man. They've looked a little rocky.
The only team that really tested them in these playoffs was Denver, and that was a 7-game fight. That was a battle. But guess what Denver didn't have? They didn't have players in depth behind Joker. Now you're going against a team that has that depth. They don't have that
team.
They don't have that quote-unquote. They don't have that quote-unquote star, superstar like a Joker, but they got 9-10 guys that they can throw out to, and they can match kind of that physicality and that tenacious D that, you know, OKC plays. And to Jason point out, they've been the best three-point team in these playoffs, 40-plus percent. So maybe that number goes down a little bit, but they've shown throughout this playoffs that they can shoot that well. And historically, their playoff numbers offensively are up there of the Showtime Lakers from the 80s. What they're doing per possession points is historically up there with Magic and those guys back in 85, 86. So this isn't just some kind of fluke run. We've seen this. They played against good teams. Cleveland, Cleveland is the best team in the NBA in the Eastern Conference. New York, good starting five. Indiana's, they're not a joke. If OKC is going to win, they're going to earn it for sure.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, since you brought up the New York Knicks, Thibodeau gets canned right after this. All right. Aaron brought it up, so let's talk about it. The New York Knicks, the New York Knickerbockers, stunned everybody after recorded the pod on Monday night. Tuesday morning, they can Tom Thibodeau. And I thought he did enough to save the job. You know, they're just games away from the NBA Finals appearance. And was it a lucky run in the playoffs? Yeah, but they won the games that they should have. And they did beat an opponent that they were built to beat, allegedly, in the Boston Celtics, the reigning NBA champs. And they just canned his ass. And there's been like lots of speculation. Like, do they already have like another coach lined up? I hear things about like, James Dolan, he's not busy with other projects anymore. Now he's back because now that the Knicks are sexy again, he's back. He wants to be part of the show.
He's done with the Spurs, and so now the Knicks are the next sexiest thing in town.
And we know if Dolan's involved, which is like, you know, why did the Knicks become good? Because Dolan stepped away and like let the people that know their job to fucking do their job. And now he's back, it looks like, because he made the ultimate decision to can Thibodeau because, you know, they haven't been in this position in like 25 years. So why the fuck not? But was it the right decision? Did this team cap out with Tibbs? Was it too little too late going deep in the roster, in the lineup?
I think if you look at Thibodeau's history, you know, Aaron and I as Bulls fans, you know, we had our Thibodeau run there for the Derrick Rose, Lou Alding.
I loved him there.
He was great. But I think got him to the same place, got him to the Eastern Conference Finals, and then couldn't get past the Heat. And I think the longer he has stayed in places, Minnesota wasn't as long, but a little bit of the same thing. His style is different than the modern NBA coach's style. Like, you play hard, practice hard. You know, they're always talking about putting the Thibodeau miles on some of the players. And we talked about it in the last pod. The difference between our last segment, Aaron talking about how deep the Pacers are, how deep the Thunder are, and how many people they use in the rotation. Thibodeau uses like six guys, maybe seven. And then he runs those six guys into the ground and you're just playing the entire game. So
it's funny.
And I know there was questions coming out, you know, to him out of that, is like, you know, they were just run down compared to the Pacers because of some of the depth stuff where things are at. So is it his fault? Also, I think there's, when you look at the front office, will they give away 5 first round picks?
For Mikhail?
For Mikhail Bridges, like,
yeah.
Now you got Giannis potentially on the market and some other things, you know, this year, but you gave away 5 for Mikhail Bridges. Is he going to pay that?
That's wild.
Because you said, you know, so what did you get out of that from a depth perspective? I know people were talking about like Hartenstein and some of these guys that I think they financially couldn't re-sign based on some of the NBA rules and stuff. So I know fans get all goofy that, oh, this is their guy and stuff, but there's certain rules that you just can't do. But I think that trade for the Mikhail Bridges is probably the one to question from the front office perspective. But is it the right move? First time the Knicks have been the Eastern Conference Finals since when, Aaron? 2000?
Yeah, 2000.
So, I mean, you're most...
Beaten by the Pacers then, too, as well.
Yeah, and we were throwing it back to the NBA on NBC. You know, we were almost there at that point. I almost got the round ball rock against.
Yeah, this happened a year too early. We needed to wait another year for the NBC to be on the broadcast rights.
We needed it. That would have been the right move, but... I think it's probably too early, because what coach are you going to get right now? You've taken the step with this team. Is it a team that can go to the finals? I don't know. I think they're not as deep as the Pacers. They don't have the talent that I think the Celtics, but you know, they'll have around there. Maybe they're even with Cleveland, but that's not saying much for what the Knicks have the expectations. So and then probably versus the West, they're not as good as 4, 5, 6 teams in the West potentially either. So is this talent and everything you're getting out of them really there that you're putting the solely on Thibodeau? So the Dolan thing, I don't know. Like I look for this. You know, Dolan owns the New York Rangers too, right? So the Rangers have been to the Stanley Cup Finals and have like some pretty good success. So I always laugh in the NBA circles around James Dolan, but he owns a hockey team too that apparently he's only interested in the basketball team, and he's ruining the basketball team, I guess, is the narrative in the media. But, you know, if he's not happy with him, man, you know, you gotta whatever the boss wants, he's going to get. And so if he's not getting what he needs out of Thibodeau, maybe there's somebody else out there. And I'm sure people potentially lining up for this job, because somebody at some point is going to win the NBA championship with the Knicks, and they're going to be a god in New York for like eternity, because we won't shut up about like Walt Frazier and the Knicks. I mean, it's the same. You have one moment in New York. I mean, I compare to this, if you're going to say for the Bears, my entire lifetime, we only talk about the 85 Bears. It's the only thing.
I'm sick of the 85 Bears.
We talk about the 85 Bears and Ditka. Like, that's
better than what the 72, 73 Knicks or whatever it was.
Yeah.
So the last one.
So in the Mecca, where basketball is home in New York City and everything like that, you've had an irrelevant franchise. You know, someone's going to want that job, and because they're going to think, I'm going to turn this around and I'm going to be a legend. You know, they're going to Theo Epstein this, man. You know, Theo Epstein, a legend, you know. Red Sox, Cubs, end of the curse. Forever legend as a GM.
Yeah, Theo Epstein is a legend. I just don't see them breaking in this like circle of what's happening in basketball. It's a good team. I say let it be a good team. Keep on tweaking it. Try getting a little further. Realistically, like, are they going to win a championship against all these good teams?
Well, they got to the Eastern Conference Finals. I mean, you're always looking for a team to progress.
This was
and get
a really
better,
good
right?
year to break.
So Tom Thibodeau Won a playoff series, got him to the second round last year.
Yeah.
Now he gets him a step further. They're two games away from getting to the NBA finals. We all talked about, I mean, I know Rome, we talked about it, you know, a few months back. We were hearing rumors then. Hey, Thibodeau gets on the hot seat, you know, quietly. He's on the hot seat.
Yeah.
We said a deep playoff run was needed. Well, they did a deep playoff run. They beat Boston. Wasn't pretty, but they beat them, even despite being down 20-plus points in four games in that series. They got here to the Eastern Conference Finals. Tough series to lose against Indiana. Competitive. I mean, all those games are pretty tight. They wore down in game six in the fourth quarter, but they I don't think you can put that game one loss on Tom Thibodeau with that team basically was up, what, 9 points of a minute, 10 to go? I don't put that loss on Tom Thibodeau. I don't really think the Knicks really choked it away. They didn't play great, but I thought Indiana was just so efficient. Naismith with, what, 5 straight 3-pointers he made? It was kind of some just ridiculousness that the Pacers did in that final 6 minutes of that game to get back in there and win it. Well, you know what? I think an article came out today that people were mad at Thibodeau because he didn't use his bench, which we've all kind of known, and he didn't make schematic adjustments throughout the series. I think he's kind of gotten, I think the Knicks and his coaching has gotten better offensively. Their defensive numbers are down this year, but that's what happens when you get rid of guys like Randle and DiVincenzo that can play defense and replace them with Kate Towns. That's not a great defender. He's a fouler. He fouls too much.
Dude, I love that after they bowed out of the playoffs, finally all these articles, literally like 30 minutes after they were kicked out, people were disappointed that Anthony Towns did not play defense.
He's not a great help side or pick and roll defender. He's just
never
not
been known for it. No,
and that's not his game. I mean, he can rebound, he can block shots, he can play down in the paint, which is why he was good to play against Denver, because you know Joker can play down there. He's got size. He can help out with Gobert when he was there for that matchup. But I mean, look at Thibodeau's out. You know, Michael Malone, he's on the market. I just saw something today that they want to talk to Jason Kidd.
Yeah.
So that's going to require them to give him some stuff. And then Mikal Bridges, nice player to bring in. I like him, but you don't give up 4 draft picks.
No.
Is that what it was?
4?
Was that what it was, Jason? I mean, I don't really know.
I threw out 5. I thought it was 5. I'll look it up while you're going.
It might be 5. It might be 8 by the time it's done, because there might be some 20, 30 picks that get thrown in late, depending on how things go. But look, we talked about it on Monday's pod.
Wow.
You see the trade or what?
Traded him for the 25, 27, 29, and 2031 first round picks. Protected pick swap in 2028. Top 4 protected in 25, and then a second round pick in 25. Yeah, so
Bridges was Brooklyn, right? That's where he came over from?
Yeah, so 5 picks and a pick swap.
Yeah. So
that's amazing.
We talked about it on Mondays that is the NBA going away from the super team model and going to the, hey, you really got to build depth. You really got to have at least 8 guys, but if you got 9 or 10, because not every series guy is going to be great. Like Josh Hart was terrible against Indiana. Unfortunately, he was in the top 3 minutes played all year. And people pointed to that. Brunson, he wore down in the playoffs. But again, that's because Indiana can throw 4 different defenders at him. They can pressure him. They didn't have a really good quality backup point guard. It goes back to not making moves at the deadline. To me, Tibbs got the most out of this team. I don't think they had the roster good enough really to get and compete in the East. I mean, I think Cleveland's better. Boston, when they're healthy, is better. Indiana obviously was better because they were both healthy when they matched up. Detroit, Rome, Detroit, you said, should have beaten these guys. And then I think people talking about, you know, the Knicks said they got rid of Tibbs because of schematics. Well, guess how many close games they won? So I don't think you can get rid of a guy who basically won 4 games in a playoff series or 3 games by a total of 4 points against Detroit and say, hey, schematic-wise, he's not doing good. Either the players make the plays or they don't. But yeah, they don't have the bench. They don't have the depth. And they got to wonder who they bring in. I think they're probably bringing in Kidd to keep Brunson around. Because remember, his dad's an assistant. So maybe the new staff coach comes in and gets rid of him. Maybe Brunson's unhappy. Then he wants out of New York. At
Do
least
you think
if he
Kidd wants to be out of Dallas, though? a fresh start.
If they weren't getting Cooper Flagg, I would say for sure. But now you
get White Hope.
Now you get a franchise player in Cooper Flagg, and you get the Lakers' first round pick. They're going to make some other trades too for some picks. I mean, I don't know. I mean, like Jason said, if you go to New York and win, you're a god. You're a legend. I mean, you win in Dallas, it's great. But yeah, I mean, New York. I think he's interested in it. I think Nico and those guys would consider it. I don't know what the compensation would be for making that type of move, but yeah, I think it's a good possibility it can happen.
Nets legend coaching the Knicks. That'd be pretty crazy. Pretty crazy. Any other basketball news? I think that's it for now, huh?
Well, Phoenix Suns hired a new coach. I don't know much about him.
Yeah, so that's... Well, that's a quick wrap up. That was the quickest.
I mean, we might as well. I mean, that's recap. Jason's guy, his new guy now. So that's making right. his hires.
That's
so
right.
That's a perfect segment into whatever's going on in their South Side, Chicago.
All right, let's talk about it.
Roman reluctantly.
I segued Jason into it, right? With the Phoenix Suns.
I appreciate it. Rome couldn't have rolled his eyes any farther in the back of his head. Like, we're going to talk about the White Sox.
That's why the lights are so dim in Rome's feed. He doesn't want you to see.
You know what? This new place has, like, recessed lighting throughout the kitchen and the bathroom, but nothing in the living room or my bedroom, and I got to go buy lighting fixtures. I don't know. This is just... I'm still unpacking, dude. This is bullshit. Anyways, all right, let's transition really quickly. We'll wrap this thing up. There was news on social this past week on some news outlets that there is a game plan in place for Ishba, the other brother. What's his first name?
Justin Ishbia
to take a controlling stake of the Chicago White Sox. With that starting no earlier, allegedly, than 2029 in 4 years. And so I sent the guys a text regarding the update. And of course, Jason reminded me that, oh, yeah, you got some good news too. Aaron Rodgers signed with your Steelers, but I'm not as excited about that right now. I don't know how to feel about that right now. But Jason, you've been posting stuff on IG since then. You know, every move they can be scratching their ass. They're like, dude, we're on the way up. Give us a rundown, man. How are you feeling about like that game? Like, cause I remember you talking about this. We have an earlier pod of how, like, that was like a dream scenario of how cool it'd be if that actually fucking happened. Well, it's fucking happening. We just don't know how soon.
Yeah. In 10 years from now. So we can save this episode, but there is a path. It is one of the more interesting, I don't even know if it's a sale or transition or whatever you want to call it. We have an agreement. The fact of the matter is Justin and Matt Ishbia, who, as Aaron mentioned, they own the Phoenix Suns and the Mercury, billionaires out of the Chicagoland area. They already own 35% of the White Sox. So they already own a good portion of this team as it is. Owner Jerry Reinsdorf technically only owns 20% of the team, but his sons have a fund controlled that they own 30%. So the total Reinsdorf really owns straight 50% of the team. So they barely have the majority. So, and that's how Jerry has it. So it has been long rumored as I've, you know, lamented on the crappy White Sox and then the Bulls. The Reinsdorf family owns both of these franchises, but it's been long said that they're only keeping the White Sox. Jerry at heart is a baseball fan. He grew up in Brooklyn. He was a Brooklyn Dodgers fan. He just loved baseball. I mean, he has a passion for the game and he wants to own this, but it's basically said his sons, you can't keep both of them. Keep one, keep the Bulls. That's the more, you know, viable one. I think it's maybe what his sons are interested in. So it's all been talked about that he was going to sell this. The Ishbia thing we talked about earlier in the year was the Ishbia brothers were looking at the Minnesota Twins that were for sale and there was potential they were going to buy them. And then they backed out. Because there was just some high asking prices for some of these baseball franchises. So as the Ishbia has backed out, and then I think the secret part of, I don't want to say it's much of a secret, but I think the reason you have this kind of ownership transition thing going on is, hey, the White Sox need money. And so the Ishbias are just injecting capital into this team. And it's a team with a below average stadium that is older, and the White Sox have already been positioning to try to get a new stadium. They basically just got some bad news, and them and the Chicago Bears look like idiots as far as securing a stadium, because the Chicago Fire, the MLS team, came out of nowhere this week and announced they were building a brand new stadium in a piece of land that the White Sox have been, you know, talking about. And it basically center field, it's called the 76. It's like in the middle of the city, and the skyline would basically be like the outfield. It's a perfect place with a big piece of land. But now the MLS is going to have, the Fire is going to have their place there. So the White Sox don't have their crap together. Reinsdorf is trying to leverage the state for money, like same way the Bears are, to pay for these stadiums. But the state of Illinois is not giving in, as they shouldn't, because of what
that
these teams are worth.
Over.
Oh, it's 100% over. And so they're figuring out which way to do it. But, you know, I know they're trying to position it. The Reinsdorf's done these veiled threats about, you know, or hasn't threatened verbally, but, you know, he's met with the mayor of Nashville because Nashville really wants to get into baseball and things like that. But I think Ishbia owning this team keeps the team in Chicago. These guys are from Chicago. I think they know that they can get more out of this team as an investment. They already own, like I said, 35%. So now what you said, the interesting structure of this deal is basically Jerry gets to kind of keep the team until he passes away, because you have...
How old is he?
He probably in his 70s, right?
No, he's older than that. I think when this deal expires in 2034, he'll be 98. So I guess he's like 89 years old now. So by 2029, that's the first pivotal date. That is the earliest the sale can go through.
Dude, he's 89.
That's triggered by Jerry. So 2029 is the earliest that he could say, hey, I'm going through. But by 2034, when he's like 98 years old, that's when the Ishbia can basically say, I'm buying the team now. So that's where it is. We don't know where the controlling portion is going to go. I just think long term, with the resources that the Ishbias have in baseball, I think guys that are willing to spend money, you look at the owner of the Mets as he came in and really, you know, started spending money left and right, have made them competitive. There are certain things in baseball you're willing to like pay one big contract to get a superstar. Like, I will lament about the Bryce Harper miss for the White Sox for my entire life, because Bryce Harper wanted to go to the White Sox and basically like, nah, we didn't want to pay him. And I think that's what's missing with the White Sox. So they're developing, and they're having this rebuilding, and they're going to be terrible for this year and maybe part of next year. But I mean, I think this is what you want. I'll ask my friends who are Angels fans, do you want to go with a guy who has $11.5 billion buying your team? Absolutely. Because at least if it's not just buying players, it's giving the resources to the team where you want to come play for this club. So I think it's all good news, but it's a typical White Sox fashion. Is the team was sold, but not until 2034.
Yeah, I just read it. So it's just an ongoing like option for like another 10 years. That's pretty crazy.
Basically, if he's breathing, you got to wait another year. By spring training, by the first pitch opening day, if he's still got oxygen in his lungs, come see me in 365 days. That's basically
crazy,
what the deal is.
Dude. That is so crazy. That's wild. But it looks like he's already injecting money into the team. So congrats, Jason.
Yeah, we'll look back at this segment finally. You know, when they pay some, you know, White Sox, still one of only two teams never to have a $100 million contract. So one of these times we'll have Justin Ishbia open up the checkbook. And
Wait. So Chicago, White Sox.
They'll have multiple $100 million once he opens
up
the
There's
checkbook.
Only two teams that have not had a $100 million player?
Yes.
Who's all right?
Is it Tampa?
Aaron,
is it Tampa? I don't know.
It would be Tampa.
Nope.
No.
Nope.
Let's see.
Oh, the A's.
The A's. Yep.
A's.
The White Sox and the A's. Only two that has never paid had a $100 million contract.
Yeah. How's Moneyball looking now? Not that good.
I don't know. The A's are not terrible this year.
Competitive. I mean, you got to get up there to Sacramento, Rome.
You
it's a nice
go,
little ballpark.
Dude, swing up, man.
Check it out.
Both of you guys swing up. Well, pretty sure Jason has one of his favorite clubs up there, too. There's a lot of politicians in Sacramento.
Yeah, it's a nice small ballpark. But yeah. But yeah, we'll see injecting cash in the White Sox. We'll see what goes. But yeah, biggest story on the timeline. Kind of got overshadowed by other things on Twitter that day, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, Aaron Rodgers. I'm not sure how to feel about that.
It wasn't even Aaron Rodgers. It was Aaron Rodgers' guy, Trump and Elon, man.
Oh, dude, it is so good. People are loving it.
Oh, that was great.
It's going to go on.
Top two Twitter day of all time.
Yeah, people are having a field day. I don't know about you guys, but I'm going to be watching the French Open for tennis. The finals is the women's is tomorrow. Men's on Sunday, I believe. Pretty cool matchups. And then I guess hockey and NBA finals tomorrow.
NBA finals is Sunday.
Nothing hockey. Saturday, huh?
Well, tomorrow, I think we touched on it Monday, is wrestling, right? Money in the Bank, Jason?
Yeah, we got Money in the Bank and UFC tomorrow.
UFC 316, so yeah. Good fight action. Segue from wrestling into the UFC, MMA, mixed martial arts. So yeah, that's what's going on tomorrow night. Afternoon tomorrow night.
Maybe I'll go out for a drink then and watch UFC at the bar over here. The sports bar.
Yeah, you got your bartender chick says she wanted to go out, right?
Yeah. Right,
there you go, man. Kill two birds with one stone.
You know, I've already dated a girl that couldn't stop drinking, and it didn't really end well for me, so.
That's still ongoing, but we won't touch base on that yet.
Are we going into the controversy segment?
It's a hell of a controversy segment. I think I can't speak on it yet.
Not quite yet.
But it will definitely have a controversy segment on it. We're at the
it'll definitely get the viewership up for sure. The numbers will go up.
Little Bank. There's Big Brain. Little Brain. Little Brain was thinking a little too much for Big Brain. You know,
that's like the tease. That's what we call a tease.
That's what we call a tease. That's what we call a tease in the business.
Well, it'll be a tough Sunday, Aaron, because you know you and I aren't waking up at 6 a.m. to turn on some F1.
But yeah. That's really tough.
Yeah, it was tough. Three straight weeks. I gotta ask because I know. I'll ask Jason now since we're talking about the six. I mean, I know there's some races coming up like at 4 or 5 a.m. Are you up that early, or are you kind of recording and then wake up like an hour or two later? Because I think there's one coming up like here in like a month, like at 4 a.m. or something. Maybe it's 5, but it's early.
No, the earliest is 6.
No, I swear there's coming up.
No,
4 a.m.
Austria, Belgium, Great Britain, like 6 or 7 a.m. Usually, if it's in Europe, it's like 6 or 7 a.m. I don't think anything like it goes off of British time or whatever. And 6 a.m. is kind of like that hard and fast like time for all the early ones. So you were looking at Azerbaijan.
That's in September.
And then the next one right after that, Singapore is at 5.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a couple months out. But I didn't know I saw some up there.
That one will be tough. That's probably a record. But, you know, in September, we're in football season. So at least we're going to have to start that one by 7, 8 a.m. if you record it, because NFL kicks off at 10. So.
Exactly. So if we time it out right, we're going right into kickoff. So yeah, that's perfect. Get the pancakes, French toast, sausage, eggs, bacon, and bam. Get that Carl's Jr. burger going.
We're rocking and rolling. Breakfast, Jesus.
8-9 hours of, you know, you get 2 hours of F1, 8-9 hours of football, and then Rome probably wants to record a podcast at 9 o'clock at night.
I think we're gonna be doing Sunday nights this year.
That's what I was afraid of. It's gonna be a 4 hour pod, Rome. I'm gonna be like, all right, we need to talk about Formula One. There's 35-40 minutes, and then we get.
And I'm gonna be lit for half of them.
Yeah,
we'll see what your schedule looks like, Rome. I think we'll have to do something.
And when Bears start 5-0 too, I'm going to be terrible. I'm just letting you know now.
Yeah, I guess it all depends if I'm opening another restaurant this fall or if I'm opening my own bar. We'll see.
If your bar, we're just doing live remote from the bar.
Damn right. I'll be bartending, making the Roman special. Double shot of Jameson or Fernet or Jaeger with the Miller High Life. Keeping it classy. All right. That'll do it. Next week, I guess we'll come back on a Monday for more recap on NHL, NBA Finals. And then I think Andrew will be joining us next week for a little F1 recap for the first third of the season and going to the next race. If you guys are down.
Always down to talk about some F1.
Awesome.
Could be F1's coming up in Canada, right?
Yeah, next week.
Could be a big thing with them winning the cup and the F1. All a possibility.
Oh,
man. Next weekend.
Big Canadian week foretold, huh?
Or could be another sad one. Who knows? They've had plenty of those up there.
Jesus. All right. Thanks for catching Source from the Sofa. Me, Aaron, Jason. We out.